An impressive military uniform displaying a Purple Heart and other medals of valor. Dog tags with the Star of David on them. Detailed wartime letters to his parents. And dramatic pictures chronicling the life of an American hero. It's all part of a new exhibit at the New Jersey Historical Society in Newark, titled The Long March Home, A World War II Story. The exhibit depicts the true story of World War II veteran Robert R. Max, who was born in Newark. Max left a comfortable college life to enlist in the U.S. Army at the age of 20 in 1942. Bob fought in three major battle campaigns across Europe before he was captured during the Battle of the Bulge and forced into Nazi slave labor. He eventually escaped, recovered from many injuries, and has dedicated his life to being a leader in business, education, and humanitarian efforts. It was Nobel laureate and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel who inspired him to talk about his experiences. Bob Max would eventually write his book, The Long March Home, in 2017 at the age of 93. I had a chance recently to sit down with the 96-year-old Bob Max at his home in Summit. It's great to see you, Bob.
Great to see you, Doug. Really, pleasure. Pleasure to talk with you.
First thing I want to ask you is, after all you've been through, you were captured by the Nazis during the Battle of the Bulge, and you lost 66 pounds, and you nearly died many times. You could have been shot many times throughout the course of your time in the war. When you see anti-Semitism in today's world, how angry does that make you, Bob?
Rather than putting in that term, angry, it's just emotional, trying to figure, and I've raised the question with many, many schooled, scholarly, rabbinic people, and I'm not sure any of us has a real answer, but invariably, when times are rough, the place to turn for solace always seems to be, have to find somebody responsible, and the Jews have always been available. And that's what it's a broad and grossly undefined reason, rationale. However, when there is dissent and rivalry, the place to turn is outside of yourself, and the Jews are always a very comfortable position for a bigot or someone who's disturbed by his life or life in general. They'll always turn and blame somebody. And the Jews have been very, very unwillingly always available. And that brings out some anti-Semitism. We've had waves of it for as long as I've lived. And I'm not sure that I see a solution to how we will change people's minds that we're like everybody else.
You know, we're almost led to believe that everybody who was a Nazi soldier did what they had to do, and they were brainwashed. But there were soldiers, and there were people who were real people, real human beings. And the soldier who basically saved your life, you were able to talk to him because he could speak good English, and you were able to strike up a conversation and gain his respect, not only because you fought against him and valiantly fought with six people, went down to five against more than 100 Nazi soldiers. But he knew that you were a real person and probably reminded him of somebody in his family. Take us back to that moment.
I'm so pleased you raised that question because it's probably a keynote or probably one of the most significant events that occurred certainly for me and as it appears in the book. Yes, we had been overrun by 100 to 150 Germans. There were six of us. There were three wounded. There were four wounded. There were two of us who survived it. And that's how we were forced into slave labor. The sergeant of the platoon that approached us in the little shack from which we were trying to defend ourselves, but that sergeant just took charge of me, and others in his unit took the other prisoners. He put his rifle on my back, marched me across the road. We got to the other side, and I saw the area was covered with foxholes. It was in the Ardennes forest, lots of trees, lots of shell blasts. Hot metal, shrapnel was landing all around us. He jumped into his foxhole. I tried to climb in with him. And he said, "Nine, nine," put his gun against my chest. The shells continued to come in. I had no weapons. I had no way of defending myself. I had run track in school, and I said, "Now's the time to use that great start you used to have." And I was going to take off. I would have been shot unquestionably. I had no weapons, so the only weapon that I really had, again, was conversation. I discovered very, very quickly, as a result of what happened next, that you must, to survive what I did, survive, there must be elements of luck. I said, "What will you do with me?" To my utter, absolute surprise, he responds in almost perfect English. Along the way, he said, "You fought well today. You killed many of our men, but you fought well." He was showing me admiration for battle. And here we were, two veterans. He had been ordered earlier, along with all the others, to take no American prisoners alive. He should have shot me at that point. I assume when he reached down, he was going for his pistol. He was a non-commissioned officer and had a right to carry a pistol. Instead, he pulls out of his pocket a wallet. He opens the wallet and shows me a picture of his family. He has a young son, a teenage son. He looks at me, and he looks at the son. He looks at me, and he looks back at his son. We never discussed this, but I was absolutely certain what he saw was another American boy. I had just turned 20. Another American boy, not much different than my son. He's got blue eyes, so is my son. He's got a little light brown hair. My son has blonde hair. That could be my boy up there. From that point on, the conversation turned very, very positive. He did say to me that when the war is over, he was a good Nazi. He was carrying out his responsibilities. But he said, "We are going to that big city of yours." He meant New York, of course. And he believed that. What he did, what he meant, when he said, "For you, the war is over," he was going to send me to a prisoner of war camp.
Bob, as we know from reading the book, A Long Journey Home, you didn't make it to the prisoner of war camp. In fact, you ended up at a site where you became a Nazi slave laborer in terrible conditions in the cold, rebuilding railroads that were blown up. But you noticed a spirit among American soldiers that really kept you going, a true sabotage effort, right?
Our job at that time as slave laborers was to repair the German railroads that were bombed. These were the railroads that were taking supplies to the troops we were fighting. If we could in some way be effectively interfere with that delivery, that would be great. There were some men, we could not talk to one another. If they caught us talking, we would either get hit with a rifle barrel across the back or, depending upon the nature of that particular guard, be shot. You could be shot. They were eligible to shoot at any time they wanted, any of the prisoners. But I could look out of you couldn't even look and smile at one another. You'd get a rap in the back. But I did look through the corner of my eyes and see what some of the men were doing. And they were pretty smart. They, for one thing, as we filled the craters where the bombs, American and British planes had dropped, created, we were to fill those bombing areas. Put them in order to be able to put the tracks back on and get those trains running again. Watching out of the corner of my eyes, I saw how we could sabotage it. We could sabotage it with the dirt that we put in, the way we put the bottom layers in. You know that the track would not be sustained when a train came over that. Others were doing things with the tracks as they put them together and all that. And so we at that time, for a very, very short period, we had joy and glee even under those conditions. We could not show that. If we started smiling as we were working, the guards would have shot anyone seeing that. They would have realized that these guys are up to something. We didn't smile. We just went about our work, pure sabotage, and again, at least enjoyed a few moments of that.
As you can certainly see in the exhibit at the New Jersey Historical Society, family has always meant a lot to Bob Max. And it was thinking about some good home-cooked dinners that actually kept your mind occupied and got you through some very, very difficult times while you were a slave laborer. Tell us about what you thought about, Bob.
The temperatures at that time, I learned later on, were 0 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So I was stripped of those winter garments, no gloves, no coat, no head, nothing for the head, anything at all. We were ordered to assemble and prepare to march, the first of many, many forced marches. Came darkness. We were ordered to lie down. We were on a road that was covered with snow and ice. We were ordered to lie down. That is where I bedded down for the next three months. I bedded down on roads like that, or sometimes in an open field. As time wore on, men began to die. We were being starved. We were given a few crumbs of dark brown inedible bread in the morning, and sometimes, if we were lucky, we would get in the afternoon a can. I don't mean a canteen. I mean a can like an old Campbell's soup can, some of them rusted with some hot water in it. If we were lucky, there was a little piece of potato in the bottom. But that was it. So men were already beginning to die. That's what I had staring at me. Nothing but death. And then I realized, you've got to find something positive to carry you on. And I turn to the emotions. I lie there each night, and I looked into the sky, and I saw the wonderful food, dishes that my mother made. She was a great cook. I said, someday, I'm going to get out of this, and I'm going to get back to that. That is what sustained me. It was also the first time I thought about escape, because I knew I had to. If the war wasn't going to end soon, I would not be alive for very long.
Eventually, you would escape. But I want to talk about fate. There were so many times that you faced death as a Nazi slave laborer and before, during various conflicts, including the Battle of the Bulge. But when you got back and recovered from your injuries, you met a wonderful woman, Shirley. You spent 67 years of marriage with her, and you've dedicated this book to her memory. You have to think about all the times that you wouldn't be here, but you had a story to tell.
The working title of my book was called Destiny. It's been a belief of mine that we have a destiny in life. I was destined somehow to survive that war, to come back and marry. I spent 10 months in hospitalized. I had many sleepless nights. And during those nights, I relived some of the events of the war, but I also was thinking about life ahead. I was still a very young guy. And a voice kept talking to me, and it kept saying somehow, Bob, you should have been dead several times. You're alive. What are you going to do about it? It was at that point that I made a determination that, yes, I'm going to spend the rest of my life engaged in activities that will help other people in their lives, which is ultimately what I did do. While hospitalized, I had another thought. I had been going to Ohio University, and interestingly enough, my major was journalism. You'll appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Doug. And I decided I wanted something a little bit more glamorous. And for some reason, I decided I wanted to go back to an Ivy League school. I wanted to go back to Cornell University. Somehow that song, I was a musician. And good music I always liked. I thought they had one of the finest theme songs in of any university's themes that I had heard, far above Cayuga's water. So I wrote home. I said, I'm not going to go back to Ohio University. I want to go back to Cornell. Be a step higher in recognition in football, et cetera. So at any rate, while I'm flying home, that voice does come to me and says, Bob, you're not going back to Ohio University. A voice. I've shared this conversation with my rabbi, trying to figure what was it? Who was it? Somehow there was a voice telling me that, no, Bob, you've got to go back. Was it my conscience? But who directed that? Somehow it came. Is an eternal being? Is that the voice that I heard? That eternal being? Was that God talking to me? But he said, you're going back to Ohio University. And that's when I made my determination. I would go back there. And that's where my world really started in activity. Because as you pointed out, Doug, I just didn't marry. It wasn't just a happy marriage. It was one of the great partnerships imaginable, because we became involved in the kind of life that I had dreamt about or thought about while hospitalized, and I happened to come across a woman on campus, very active. We were both very, very much leaders, campus leaders, and we just happened to come together. That's destined, in my view, that was destiny. We were destined somehow to come together. She had the same views as I did, and so we were not just married alone. We were absolute partners. When I decided I had enough of big business and when started my own businesses, we started it together. She was always my sounding board, and she was the inspiration. She was the voice that had me go through not just my second bar mitzvah when I turned 83, a third bar mitzvah at age 96. I might be the only living person in the world who now has had three bar mitzvahs. Kirk Douglas was listed as one. He was due, he was due in December. Kirk Douglas just passed away, the movie actor. So I might be the only person living who had gone through three bar mitzvahs. And that was the influence, again, of my wife.
I had mentioned earlier about your commitment to family. Your letters that you sent to your mom and dad and the correspondence that you had with them are on display at the exhibit at the New Jersey Historical Society. They meant so much to you.
Yes. My mother was a great saver. Every letter I wrote from the time I left home to go to college, from then all through military, she saved all those letters. My wife, Shirley, was a great collaborator. She could take and she could make something out of just a pile of pictures, and she did. She cataloged it all. She saved all the artifacts that became very valuable. Which is why they are now resting at the New Jersey Historical Society Museum in Newark. I can tell you that the collection itself that evolved to a large extent from the war, but there's much, much in there that has to do with the life that followed after the war, when we both became active and remained active for more than 60 years in the organized Jewish community, providing life-saving, life-building services for humanity, for Jews, but well beyond that too, because many of the services, the agencies we have worked with over the years, serve people in various stages of need, and that has been our, that was our lives. So we were a partnership, and when it came time for me to establish new business, that I knew there were large corporations that needed certain things, communication skills really, and I built a completely new communication system that would train middle management above personnel to be able to communicate in writing and in speech effectively, more effectively. I had every major insurance company, every major pharmaceutical company in the greater New York area. They were all clients of mine. I mention this simply because that was what happened when Shirley and I became married. It was, again, not marriage alone, but marriage plus partnership. Shirley initially managed all the internal affairs, set up all the structures. We hired 20 people, and they all worked. We set them up as it was just great, great business. But that again is the destiny that somehow that voice from above guided me back to Ohio University and Shirley.
Destiny, indeed. We're speaking with Bob Maxey, is the author of The Long March Home, An American Soldier's Life at a Nazi Slave Laborer, and we're here at his home in Summit. You were born in Newark, though, right?
Born in Newark, right.
And then your family moved to South Orange.
South Orange, this is right. That's where they lived during the war period, yes.
Well, Bob, you know the WBGO is a jazz station, so to know about the big band era in Newark, you know, obviously captures my attention. Tell us about the Paramount and also the Adams Theater in Newark.
Yes. My first year, when I was eligible for college, graduated high school, I decided I wanted to stay local. And so I did choose NYU, commuted to NYU in a downtown campus every day. I chose NYU and chose my own course that would allow Fridays to be free. So I went to college for four days a week. Friday was very important to me because the big swing bands of that era came to Newark, where we had two theaters, the Paramount Theater on Market Street and the Adams Theater. These were the top musicians in America. It was what was called big band swing, when they had brass, trumpets, trombones, saxophones, and a four-person rhythm section, piano, guitar, drums, and a bass, string bass. And that was the makeup of the bands. That was called big band swing. And all very popular tunes, very, very melodic, beautiful. I was playing clarinet and alto saxophone. So Artie Shaw and Benny Goodman, two different, slightly, somewhat different styles in their playing, but both highly, the best of their era, and possibly two of the best clarinetists who performed publicly ever. And so I admired them, When either of those bands, I went regardless of what band. I just followed all of the big bands through the trade journals, and I knew who the musicians were, too. That will be a factor later on if we get to that, how I went into the Army and I was surrounded by some of these same people I'm just describing to you who played in the big bands.
There was an opportunity for Bob, because he was a terrific musician in the Fort Dix Swing Band, that he could stay behind. But he wasn't going to let that happen. He was going to war.
The leader of the band was named Jack Leonard, yes. He was the singer, the male. Most of those big bands had a male and a female singer. Jack Leonard was with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. So he came to Fort Dix, as did so many of the top musicians in America, all volunteered. And it was Jack Leonard who then intervened in my behalf, unknown to me. My name appeared on a list to be shipped out to go in to be trained for combat. Jack had my name withdrawn, and I was called into the office, and he said, "No, we need you. We want you to stay with the band here." I said, "No, Jack, my buddies are all going off to war. That's where I belong. That's why I volunteered and signed on as quickly as I could." And he said, "Kid, if you leave here now, you're not ever coming back." And that was close to reality. But I did leave ultimately and shipped out and did end up in the European theater during World War II.
I think that's all you need to know about Bob Max is that decision. He was committed not only to his buddies, but he was committed to his country. What an amazing story. And now it's being celebrated at the New Jersey Historical Society with the exhibit. Your favorite item in the exhibit is?
Probably my dog tags, strangely enough. On my dog tags, in addition to a letter H, which was stamped into it. If you were Jewish, it was either a J or an H for Hebrew. In addition to that, when I got my dog tags at Fort Dix, I attached to them a Star of David, an obvious, religiously recognized piece, you might call it jewelry, and also a miniature mezuzah of mezuzahs similar to the mezuzahs that are fixed to the doorposts as a form of spiritual protection. But whatever. I was young, I was defiant, and even though I was going into Nazi Germany, where Adolf Hitler had declared war on the Jewish people, I decided I was not going to avoid my Jewishness. We were told as we entered combat that if you are Jewish and you are captured, throw away your dog tags. But as I've just mentioned, I was young. I was idealistic. And I was defiant. I said, "No way. They're not going to stop me from being who I am." And I wore them. If I had gone to a prisoner of war camp instead of into slave labor, where they didn't care who or what you were a body, and only as long as you could work, you stayed alive. So they didn't care. But at any prisoner of war camp, they probably would have interrogated me, had me open my shirt, they would have seen the dog tags. And people say, "Oh my gosh, in a way you were lucky." I said, it really didn't make any difference at all, because the way they might have treated us as Jews could not have been worse than the way we were treated in slave labor. When you don't eat, you're starved, you're frozen, you're beaten, and you're shot. I mean, you can't get treatment much worse than that. And so, it really did. So that didn't really make any difference, and I was not going to give up my religion. No, I did not throw away my dog tags. And that's my favorite item. Back to your question again, Doug. That's my favorite item of all the things that are in that exhibit, and some of them are really most unusual, but that one personally means so much to me.
Well, this man would go on to win gold medals in sprints in the Senior Olympics. He would go on to help make music for the Bat Masterson album. He would go on to do many great things. He also has an American flag on his desk, and I can't think of anybody better to be displaying the American flag. Bob Max, what a pleasure, what an honor to speak to you. Thank you for your service, and we invite everybody to see your life on exhibit at the New Jersey Historical Society, The Long March Home. And when he got home, he didn't stop. Robert R. Max, An American Soldier's Life as a Nazi Slave Laborer.
Doug, that book is available through Amazon, And there are many reader reviews there. I would urge anyone who might be interested in that period of what life was like in America and in combat and during that time, I would encourage them to go to Amazon, really, to get hold of that book, principally because it carries out the mission that I'm still engaged in at age 96, and that is talking. I talk to many, many schools among other audiences. The whole purpose is so that the world will never forget, and future generations of our young people will remember what happened during that period, and so that if anything like that occurs again, and there's another dictator that faces the rest of the world, they will recognize it and they will speak up. And that's why the book that I wrote is so important. And I hope people will respond to that, go to Amazon or their local bookstores and ask for the book itself.
Bob, as we look into each other's eyes during this interview, I understand why the Nazi soldier listened to your story. Mm. You have a magnetism, sir. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And I've enjoyed every minute of it. And I hope people will hear, many, many people will hear what you have just recorded. Thanks so much.